Hi, Steve Pomerantz here, host of On the Money with today's On the Money Extra, where we feature market updates and insights as well as guest interviews with noted financial experts to help you stay informed and learn the facts to make the right decisions about money. So let's get started. A few years ago, my next guest asked an unusual question. He pondered, can the poor save capitalism? And it was this question that led to a best-selling book, a book which took a revolutionary approach to the age-old problem of poverty. I'm pleased to have him back again to discuss his ideas in light of the events of the past few months in Baltimore and Ferguson. John Hope Bryant, welcome back to the program.
Nice to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming on because I know you just flew in from Norway and you're headed to Alabama, so appreciate again you taking the time to sit with us. Before we get to the issues at hand, allow me to revisit some of the basic ideas of the book. You make an important distinction between being broke and being poor, and I know many of us, including me, can say that I have been broke, but being poor is different. Why?
Because being broke or being wealthy has nothing to do with money. That half of poverty is just low self-esteem and lack of confidence in yourself and lack of belief. And you and me have the benefit of growing up with an environment of love and support, generally speaking. And then you've got the second part of poverty, which is crappy role models and a crappy environment. And if all you see in your neighborhood are rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers, then nobody should be surprised that young people growing up wanting to be a rap star, an athlete, or a drug dealer. It actually is quite rational, even though it's quite unreasonable. And then, of course, if you hang around 9 broke people, you'll be the 10th. And that is the culture and the environment aspect. The last piece of it is just a lack of hope. The most dangerous person in the world is a person with no hope. You know, everybody can fit in this category I just described to you of poverty. You can define that all around the world, Steve. But if you look at African Americans in America, there's a sort of a double entendre, a negative here. It's 200 years of slavery, the only people enslaved on American soil, 100 years of Jim Crow, ending basically in our lifetime. So we're not talking about 100 years ago. So basically, you have people who are depressed. 70% of Black America, I believe, are clinically undiagnosed depressed. And if you're depressed and you have no hope, or you have a lack of hope because you think you're outside of the band of aspirational opportunity and you never got the memo on free enterprise and capitalism, then you end up being a spark looking for a match in places like Baltimore and Ferguson.
So, you know, commerce and finance are the currency or the culture of this country, and it's what's made it so powerful. Is this the memo you're talking about, the fact that people don't really have, they're not instructed, they're not taught in this language of commerce and currency and finance?
Yes, and it goes back to Abraham Lincoln and March 3rd, 1865, when he created a Freedmen's Bank to teach free slaves about money. It was after the Civil War, and it was after Emancipation Proclamation, right after, and he thought the most important thing he could do, Steve, was to create a bank to teach free slaves about money, call it financial literacy today, and to give them access to capital. And right before that, he had given them 40 acres and a mule through something called Field Action 15, done by one of his generals literally in the field. Well, he was killed 5 weeks later.
Yeah.
And that bank fell in disrepair, and 73,000 depositors, Black, former slaves, lost half of everything they owned. And there was never any healing from that. And you fast forward 100 years, and there was no conversation about free enterprise again until Dr. King, a pastor, basically, not an economist, a pastor, tried to revisit the conversation of poverty. He was killed April of 68. And we didn't have that conversation again until I wrote this book that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, it's not like we gave a memo on free enterprise and capitalism to poor people, and they screwed it up. We just never gave anybody the memo.
You talk about that Freedmen's Bank and as that being the start of really kind of the decline. You had the emancipation of the slaves in the 1860s and then the Freedmen's Bank. But the bank was established by the legislature, and yet after Abraham Lincoln's death, it fell into disrepair. Is that because, would you say that Abraham Lincoln was the power behind that? I mean, it took one man really to kind of push this, and once he was gone, the country couldn't get behind it?
Yeah, I think that leadership counts. It counts in your, I mean, we had a situation, we won't go into detail, in the last couple hours trying to, you know, coordinate what we're doing today, and you just never gave up, right? And that's leadership. And that counts whether you're running a household or running a business or running a city. You know, you never, ever, ever give up. You have this can-do attitude about life, and that was Abraham Lincoln. So I do believe that he was imperfect. Look, you know, he made a lot of mistakes, and, you know, people who know history know that he didn't free the slaves because it was a moral grounds. It was a great strategic move, but I don't really care why he did it. I care that he did it. The reality is that he did have a set of values and set of principles that he backed up with leadership. And when he died, it died. Worse, he had made a strategic misstep. He had created a vice president post where he put a team of rivals' philosophy, a segregationist from the South, as vice president because he wanted to bridge back to the South after the Civil War. It was actually a brilliant strategy, assuming he had lived.
Yeah.
He assumed that nobody was going to kill him after the war, Steve. He assumed that he'd be killed during the war. So when he survived the war, he figured, okay, now it's rebuilding time. Well, when he was killed, who became president? The vice president. So this guy, who was horrible, Andrew Johnson, I believe is his name, the worst president we've ever had, reversed everything he could that Lincoln had his hands on. Reversed Field Action 15, canceled as much as he could, pulled the federal troops out of the South. And that's where Black Codes came from. That's how you had, for 100 years, local laws in the South in direct conflict with federal law. What Dr. King did in the 60s, by the way, for your listeners, those two or three civil rights bills, those were not new laws. They were just enforcement actions for old laws. Blacks already had the right to vote. It wasn't enforced. You know, all that stuff, Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, Open Housing Act, all that stuff done by local leaders in the South was against the law. So Andrew Johnson created 100 years of mayhem after Lincoln died.
My guest is John Hope Ryan, and the book is Can the Poor Save Capitalism? You wrote an article recently for American Banker magazine, and it was entitled The Lessons from Baltimore, Middle Class Folks Don't Riot. Allow me to quote that real quick. Assuming that race, policing, and profiling are systemic and nationwide in scope, wouldn't we see riots in middle class black and brown communities? But we don't. We don't because middle class folks don't want riot or strife. Can you talk to that, please?
Yeah, and I'm impressed that you found that article also. That was for mostly a banking journal. That's impressive that you even found that in a day. Yeah, it's a provocative statement, but I think it's common sense. You know, middle-class folks, let's just say be blunt, middle-class black people do not riot. But middle-class nobody riots because at a certain point, once you reach an aspirational engagement, you own a home, you own a business, you have a job, you're engaged in the benefits of the free enterprise system, the benefits of finance, the benefits of American dream. You're not a black person or a brown person or a green person, or an orange person. You're a green person. Everybody becomes part of prosperity. And so that sort of should be an obvious to people who are sort of writing off black people as, you know, nutcases or whatever, or look at them tearing up their city. You know, only black poor people, almost 100% of all riots are black urban poverty based over the last, you know, almost 100 years. And it's a combination, I told you, it's just this toxic mix of all the wrong things. Low self-esteem, depression, for reasons I've already articulated, lack of access to mainstream levers of success and opportunity, never getting the memo, not having access to things like financial services at a mainstream basis that will lift you up. Just the opposite. You've got predators in these communities, payday lenders, check cashers, rent-to-own stores, title lenders that are targeting a 500 credit score customer.
Yeah.
See, this modern slavery. What's going on right now is modern slavery.
I want to quote something from that article as well. It says, after 23 years of doing this work, I am convinced that outside of God or love, nothing changes your life more than raising your credit score. Why is this credit score so important to uplifting people from poverty?
Because half of employers today will tell you they won't hire you unless they run your credit. Because credit score modeling of computers is as ubiquitous and consistent and overwhelming in your life as a flat screen, touch screen on a cell phone is today. I mean, Steve Jobs changed everything with the touch screen technology. Even his competitors are stealing it. Well, you know, credit scores are like today what a public record was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, you can't get arrested, whatever, because that's going to follow you the rest of your life. You might be able to get around not getting arrested. I mean, the fact you've been arrested today, but you can't get around your credit score.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'd rather have a conviction on my record and a great credit score than no convictions on my record and a 500 credit score.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because that credit score is going to say more about you than a one-time conviction, which seems to be really upside down, doesn't it?
Yes, and so in that regard, the article suggests that we're looking for love at all the wrong places, we're digging in the wrong holes, and I'm not jamming up my fellow civil rights leaders. I'm a civil rights leader, by the way, silver, not civil. I'm a businessman and an entrepreneur who engages in community, not a community leader. But I'm not jamming up all the good people with goodwill who are fighting legitimate cases of oppression, fighting legitimate cases of brutality, fighting legitimate cases of police brutality. These are legitimate cases. I'm just simply saying we're looking at the cough and calling it a cold.
Mm-hmm.
The cough is not the cold. The cough is an indication that you're sick. So somebody needs to say, what's the reason for the sickness? And what I've just articulated to you, I believe, is the reason for the sickness.
You know, your Project Hope has worked out an arrangement with Regions Bank. Regions Bank, I think, being based in Baltimore. What does that represent to you? What are they doing, and what do you hope to accomplish?
By the way, your brilliant brain, Steve, just merged two Operation Hope names. You merged Operation Hope and Project 5117.
Okay, sorry.
Project Hope. It's fine. So Regions Bank just announced a commitment to open side location just outside of Ferguson, Missouri, where my family grew up 10 miles from, by the way, in East St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant a lot to me emotionally and spiritually. And we're negotiating with another bank right now, I can't say who they are, to open up in Baltimore. But what I'm hopeful of is that if the mayor of Baltimore came to me and said, and we have another open side with Regions Bank in Birmingham, Alabama, where I am not right now, by the way, and they're opening up two more, as I understand it. But if the mayor of Baltimore came to me and said, look, John, I need something new and fresh. I need a new approach to this problem. But you got to promise me I'm going to have success. You have to promise me, bet your net worth, your reputation, that I'm going to have success. That I have 2 years or less to fix this, or I'm out of office. What do I do? I'd say, give me a Project 5117 office of authorization every 4 square blocks in your city, and I'll guarantee you that you not only not have a problem anymore, you'll have a lowering crime rate on an increasing or decreasing ratio, meaning increasing timing and geography decreasing ratio of criminal activity. You'll have an increasing ratio of jobs and GDP. You'll have an increasing ratio of opportunity and ownership, and you'll have an increasing tax base, and you'll have a poor neighborhood that will turn into an emerging market.
This is Project 5117, is that what you said?
Project 5117.
What exactly is that?
It's an acronym for 5 million kids to make smart cool so kids want to stay in school, 1 million kids to go through Hope Business in the Box Academies and the D-minus Business Compact to become entrepreneurs and business interns so you can go get a job or create a job. We'll fund them right out of high school, by the way, in the Hope Business in the Box Academies. 1,000 Hope Inside locations inside of bank branches, credit unions, grocery stores, big box retailers, houses of faith, government offices, where we're going to open 1,000 locations to put within basically the private banker for the working man and woman. We've opened up 100 of those locations last year alone, and we've announced 100-plus locations additionally this year alone. And we have a plan by 2020 to be at 1,000 locations, and we're ahead of schedule. And then all that leading to 700 credit scores. So 5117. 5117, with the ultimate goal being 700 credit score communities.
I see. So the idea basically, again, is you're taking a bootstrap approach. You're trying to fix the problem from the inside out, not with programs so much, but with education and institutional help in order to create some bank accounts, to talk about budgeting, to talk about the nature of money. Am I on track with that?
Yes, but it's more than education, because you've got to connect education with something practical and real and their aspiration. Nobody wants it. You want to put a kid to sleep, give them a traditional financial literacy course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to tie. These kids are dealing with bullets flying over their head, no mama at home, don't know who their daddy is, frustrated, pissed off, upset, no job. So they need more than an abacus. They need something more than a wish, hope, and a prayer, go get an education, things will be better. They need to connect education with a J-O-B.
Okay.
So I'm connecting education with aspiration and making it very real.
How do people help or get involved in their local area with something like this?
Become a member of Operation Hope. I'm the biggest individual donor to Operation Hope, John Hope Bryant. I mean, I came from Compton, California, in South Central L.A. I don't know how much money I put in this organization, but it's clearly, you know, over time, 7 figures. And I put my credit card up every month now just to finance it, its travel and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an 81%, I mean, it's got a 4-star charity navigator rating, which is unprecedented for an organization of our sort, which is for accountability and transparency, meaning 81 cents of every dollar goes to help real people, 19 cents goes to overhead with complete transparency. But that means that 19 cents to sort of pay for everything. Mm-hmm. So I end up backdooring this thing with my own support. So they can become a member of Operation Open at whatever level they're comfortable. They can go to operationhope.org to do that. They can become a volunteer, become a Hope Corps member, volunteer their time if they don't have money. They can sponsor a Hope Inside location inside of their big box retailer, grocery store, church, synagogue, mosque, government office, you know, bank, credit union, wherever they happen to be. We're even opening them up in hotels. For the employees of the hotel, because most of those people are working class. So this is a human resource benefit for the employees of most companies where people make $50,000 a year or less. So they can volunteer, they can become a member. You know, this is a new movement, Steve. The last movement was in the streets. This movement is going to be in the suites.
Interesting.
The last movement was about civil rights, and this one's about civil rights. And it relates to everybody. Whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow today, you want to see some more green.
John Hope Bryant, the author of Can the Poor Save Capitalism, also the founder of Operation Hope. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. Take a good rest there, John. I know you just came back from Norway.
Thank you, brother. God bless you. I'll come anytime. I'll come on anytime. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to On the Money with certified financial planner Steve Pomerantz. If you'd like information about guests, topics, or anything you hear on this program, call 866-MONEY01 or visit the show's website at onthemoneyradio.org.